Good morning. Today it's a real privilege to welcome a good friend and former colleague of over 35 years in Peter Donegan. Our paths connected at the old Greater 3UZ back in 1978. Pete was a young man just starting to break into the world of broadcasting, and I was a touch older having started at the Greater 3UZ in 1972. Like our principal caller at the time, Johnny Russell, we all identified the natural talent at that early stage of Peter Donegan, a young man from Albert Park. Fast forward almost 40 years, and we have a man who's at the top of his profession, without doubt one of Australia's finest all-round sports commentators. Good morning, and welcome to This Is Your Racing Life, Peter Donegan.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be with you, although I must say I'd be a lot more comfortable if I was sitting over your side and asking the questions rather than having the questions asked of me.
Pete, you're looking good. How are you travelling?
I'm very well, Brian. Coming to the end of what's been another busy year with sports of all different persuasions, just having done 3 weeks of great golf here in Australia as well, and sharing the commentary box with the likes of Ian Baker Finch and Wayne Grady over the last 3 weeks. So I'm a lucky boy.
When you sort of rewind back over your time in broadcasting, I remember, I think you were still at school when you sort of wandered into the studios of 3UZ and you tagged along with me, and we built up a great association. I think one of the real premise of getting along was we didn't take it too seriously. We had a bit of fun.
We did have a bit of fun, and that stood me in good stead for the rest of my career in broadcasting, because you can get very serious about all of these things. But when I was that young fellow alongside you, who I admired greatly, and you took me under your wing and showed me a lot of the things that I needed to do in broadcasting, having fun was one of them. And so that's something that I've always tried to carry through, and hopefully that has worked over the years. So I've got you to thank for that and a lot of other things too.
Yeah, we won't go down that path just yet, Pete. This is a long program. We're going to fill an hour. Don't think we'll have any problem. The early days of the Greater 3UZ, because and I want to focus on that, because then I want to go across and looking at your CV, you know, I knew you were out doing something. I knew you were overseas doing something, and I'm going that way. But it's more about what you were doing, and you might not have been in the mainstream of telecasting with different sports, but you're out there, and I'd catch up with you and you'd say, I've just done 3 weeks of golf in Asia for the Asian Broadcasting Unit, da-da-da-da-da. But back to those days of 3UZ and the Greyhounds, like Olympic Park here in Melbourne back in the 70s and the 80s, I talk to people now and I say, you know, we were there calling with, in later years, Ronnie Hawkswell, but starting there when 3UZ went into the Greyhounds back in 1972, you came on a couple of years later, but they'd get 4,000 or 5,000 people there at Olympic Park on a Monday night, 3 or 4 rows of bookmakers. It was just massive.
Oh, it was. It was huge. And when the big races would come up, like the Australian Cup, I always remember down the back straight there at Olympic Park, and they used to be 4 and 5 deep down the back straight to watch it. It was big. It was very big in those days, and Sandown Park likewise. And it is hard to tell people now that when you drive down Swan Street, not far away from where we are, or Olympic Boulevard, as it's called now, the old Olympic Park Greyhound track used to be in there, and the younger generation will say, well, I never heard of that.
Yeah.
Sandown's still there. We've got the Meadows now. So the Greyhounds, when you look at it, you started off doing a lot of Greyhound calling. So did I. So did Bruce McAvaney. I think if you can call the Greyhounds, you can probably just about call anything.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I talk to people about that too. And I say to them, if you could master calling Greyhound racing in 30 and a half seconds, the speed they move at, obviously, it's over in a half a minute. To get through the field, maybe get through the field again, then focus on the first 3 or 4 turning for home. It held you in good stead, because harness racing or trotting, as we knew then, they slowed down, they went 4 minutes, they jumped into a sort of procession-like format, and nothing really changed. Thoroughbreds were in between. And then we got to the Stall Gift, which was over in, 11 seconds.
Yeah.
So to be able to focus on those different sports and get your speed right, get your breathing right, and, of course, your delivery, that was a challenge.
It was, and not only was it 30 seconds, but sometimes they introduced the races that were a little bit shorter than that. Mm. I remember at Geelong, where I did a lot of my calling, 347 metres was the distance. So it would take around about 20 seconds or a little bit less. And our great friend Ted Ryan, many years ago, I think actually tried one out to get a sponsor credit in at the start of the race and said something like, so they're all set, green light's on, Away they go in the Geelong Cement Mixers Grade 5 stakes here at Geelong. And Brian Martin leads around the turn and won.
That's about right too. Yeah. Those days of, as we say, Olympic Park and Sandown Park, and with the Greyhounds, of course, with the Cup meetings and the Australian Cup series run over 3 weeks, same with Sandown, the distance championships, etc. But around those feature races, there'd be a ball. Like, there'd be a ball a week before, and it was, you know, sort of a black tie, and it'd be at the Southern Cross or wherever, or Chaucers. And I remember hosting the Greyhound of the Year at Chaucers way, way back in about the mid-70s. You were just on the scene, I think it was, but it was, you know, we're there on the touches, mm-hmm. etc. And Mike Preston was the act. Yes. For the night, who was doing in Melbourne tonight, and it was a big act in Melbourne, big act in Australia, Mike Preston, former Englishman, but a real showman. Anyway, it was the halfway mark through the dinner, and it was time to introduce the act. So, ladies and gentlemen, would you please make welcome one of the great stars of show business in Melbourne tonight. Here he is. Make welcome Mike. I forgot his bloody surname.
Oh, no.
I forgot his surname. And Mike, we've loved him over the years. Mike, and here he is coming on stage now, you know, and the brain is trying to find what is his surname. There was a bloke right next to me on table 7. He said, Preston.
Well, I had a similar thing many years later. I got called in to host the Cox Plate Ball one night.
Yeah.
Tim Watson was supposed to do it but fell ill that afternoon. And so they actually rang me at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon and said, can you come and do it? And literally, I got there at 6 o'clock, didn't know the running order or anything like that. And we had a special guest, and I think this gentleman was, a magician. Couldn't tell you what his name is now, and I couldn't tell you what his name was on the night too, because I went to introduce him, I called him the wrong name. So, but the same thing happened to me once. We were doing a racing function, I think at Crown. And they had one of those pre-recorded intros, and so I was just waiting backstage at Crown, just trying to focus in my mind as to everything that was going on, and the pre-recorded intro came on. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Victorian Racing Awards, and would you please make welcome your host for the evening, Peter Derrigan. And I thought, is there someone else here? And so my beloved often refers to that when she wants to just put me down a peg or two. She just, Peter Derrigan, just don't you worry about it. So it's happened to us all over the years, mate.
Yeah, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. Those early days, we all had to do the hard yards. I went to 3UZ and Bert Bryant was there. He was the king broadcaster. There was Bert on 3UZ. And we had this luxury of having Bill Collins on 3DB. Like, radio listeners to racing were absolutely spoiled. And then Sydney had Ken Howe and then Johnny Tapp coming along. It was the golden years, as I refer to them back then. We were the changing of the guard in our own sort of way. But we did the yards of going to the country harness racing, trots. We called them trots. We didn't call them harness racing. And you'd be off to stall during the day. And I remember going to Oyu, and you remember going to Wangaratta.
Yes.
A guy tweeted me yesterday and he said, ask him about going up to Wang and calling night trots up at Wang and Warrigal.
Well, I actually started at Wangaratta calling the greyhounds. That was my very first job. Yeah. And I was still at school. And Ron Hawkswell, who you mentioned before, was course broadcaster at Wangaratta. And it was when Cranbourne opened up for first time with the greyhounds. And Ron got the job at Cranbourne. So I went up. My dad drove me up there because I was too young to have a licence at 17 years of age. So he drove the 250 kilometres up to Wangaratta and I called them. And Kevin Pitt, who was the secretary manager, said, I think we'd like to have you back, young fella. So I did those for a couple of years and then went on to Geelong. So Wangaratta's got a very, very fond place in my heart in my broadcasting career.
When you start out as a caller, as a broadcaster, to get to the station, to a leading Melbourne sports station, racing station, was just a feat in its own. To get a gig, you know, I started as number three banana and you were probably number four or number three coming through the
44, rec- I think.
44, but you rose swiftly. But just getting that opportunity to do it, you thought, well, if it stops now, I've done it. You know, it's fantastic. And you're quite happy to do it then.
Exactly. And I was quite happy many times with you early in my career to just sit in the box and be whatever assistance I could. And then at various times throughout the night, I'd have my little tape recorder and I'd go out on the roof Olympic Park and call the races there and just try and improve. But you've got to do the hard yards and you've got to be prepared to do stuff that you wouldn't necessarily think that you were going to do early in your career. And it stands you in good stead later.
Remember Johnny Ryan? very big gambler, punter.
Yes.
I still see Johnny around, but Johnny loved betting on the greyhounds.
Yes.
And I don't know where you were at the time. Might have been the early 80s, and you might have, you would have normally been at Olympic Park with me. But I was calling up till about race 8, and John would do the last two.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I left early about race 6, and there was a champion jumping greyhound called New Fine.
Mm-hmm.
And John was one of the biggest punters at Olympic Park and Sandown Park, yet he was still doing the call for 3UZ at the time. And I think his course, well, his fee for the night was something like $40.
Yeah.
We're never overpaid, were we?
No, not exactly. And
no.
At least that still continues to
this
day.
Yeah, it does. The tradition continues. Johnny was getting about $40 for the night for being the assistant at Olympic Park this night. This greyhound New Farm was going for about 10 on end and was in the hurdle championship final. It was 7-2 on. And John had something like 7,000 to 2,000 on.
Mm.
And was getting $40 wages for the night. Work that out. Anyway, the call goes, and I'm sitting in the corner of Punt Road and Swan Street going home because I've got to go to Stall Trots or something the next day. Johnny's had 7-2, large.
Mm.
And I remember listening to the call. He said, racing, Pete Starr jumps out 2 lengths in front of Get Smart on the outside, then Brian's Wish further back. And there goes the champ, New Fine. As I go over that one, New Fine jumped it brilliantly. He goes 4 lengths out in front of Pete Starr and Brian's Wish on the outside. Down the back, he leads 6 lengths now, New Fine. Look at him stride out. Oh, he's gone. And stopped.
Nothing.
He stopped.
Yeah.
the dog fell. He lost $7,000.
Yeah, if there were seven gorillas on it, I don't blame him for stopping. I always remember John being in the box there at the time when he used to come in and, as you say, do the last three races or so. And the wads of cash that he used to produce out of his pockets.
Yeah.
And I thought, gee, well, he's clearly not getting it from broadcasting. so he must have been a very good judge.
And a big card player too.
Yes, he was.
But that call stopped. I think I stopped on a green light. The whole world stopped because New Fine fell.
Well, remember the other one, the other famous one at Olympic Park? Remember Roo Power, the great Roo
Power?
Yes,
yeah.
And, of course, they used to race on Moomba Monday night. And Roo Power was in an invitation on Moomba Monday night and jumped straight on the bunny, as she used to do, and led about 5 lengths down the back. Unfortunately, they started the Moomba fireworks display as she was halfway down the back straight. And Roo Power, shall we say, got the shock of her life and didn't know what to do when the first bang hit, so she stopped. And after that, I don't think they ran the Olympic Park Greyhounds in conjunction with the Moomba fireworks.
Beaten by a penny bunger.
Yes.
They were great times, Pete.
Yeah.
And when we look back now, you know, your time with you know, taking over from the Hawk with the Greyhounds on the provincial tracks. And then there was a shift of 3UZ sort of getting away from racing, and I got a chance to go to 3DB. I think I could see that racing, and it was very hard to fathom after racing had been there for 40 years or something at 3UZ at the top of the charts. It was moving away, that management were moving away from it. And 3DB got the contract, as you know, in 1984. Mm. You stayed there with Johnny Russell, who was the chief caller at the time, and it sort of took on the slogan as the Thoroughbred.
Yes.
You remember all that time?
Yes.
And a difficult time for you guys.
And we were told at the time, when you went across to 3DB to continue your career, we were told at the time that 3UZ would continue to do thoroughbred racing until a year dot.
That's
there
right.
was no plans to drop it.
The other two codes had been dropped.
Yes, yeah. And they went over to 3DB.
That's right.
So they took up the broadcasting of those. And so I had a choice to make, and Bill Collins spoke to me. And I had a choice to make and decided to stay at 3UZ. Well, 6 months later, of course, we were called to the now infamous meeting that John Russell talks about a bit.
Still.
And,
don't blame him.
And says that that was it. And so all of a sudden I was left without a job. But I did get to call the Melbourne Cup that year.
You called Kiwis Cup in 83.
Yeah.
What a year to call it.
Incredible. I still can't believe it. One of the great cups of all time. And when I saw his colours at the 200, I thought, no, can't be Kiwi.
No.
It was impossible.
When you look at the vision, Pete, of that Kiwi win, and I spoke about this with Jim Cassidy just recently on this program, and you see the vision actually really tells the tale, because at Chiquita Lodge, he must be 35, 40 lengths.
I would think so, yeah.
And Jim tells the story about talking young Jimmy Cassidy trying to get some sort of, you know, some guidance from Roy Higgins, who came forward with, you know, where are you going to be at Chiquita Lodge. I'll be last, Mr. Higgins, he said. Where do you think you'll be at the half mile? I'll still be last. Da, 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 da. Where will you be at the tower? The Stewart's Tower, the famous Stewart's Tower, you know, inside the 2 furlongs. I'll probably still be last. And Roy said, oh, is that right? And he was doing a telecast a little later on Channel 10. He said, oh, this young Cassidy tells him he's going to coming from last on Kiwi. You know, he's in for a big shock.
Yeah.
So well, he
was still about 10th of the 200, I think.
Exactly.
I love the story of the day after. Our old friend Darren Hinch, I think, was on radio that day and started criticising the race callers for not calling Kiwi.
That'd be right.
John Russell had a reply. I don't know whether he rang him, but his reply was, well, the simple explanation is, Darren, you can't bloody call what's not bloody there.
Exactly.
And he wasn't there.
He wasn't. No.
Incredible.
So a change in your career coming up. We're going for a break because racing had been dropped at 3UZ, the old 3UZ, and Pete was out of a job, but things were only going to get better. This is Your Racing Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We'll be back after this break. We're back with Peter Donegan, special guest, a very special guest on This Is Your Racing Life on this Saturday morning. Pete, the curtains had come down at 3UZ. You're out of work. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, at that stage, I spent a bit of time in Tasmania because I was engaged to a beautiful girl from Tasmania.
Broman,
mm-hmm. who was, in fact, Miss Tasmania. So well, I was batting way above my average there, completely fighting out of my weight division. So I went down to Tassie and did a bit of calling down there, but I always thought, because of the broad interest I had in sports, that I'd write a few letters to the television stations. And I did that to Channel 7, and all of a sudden in April, I went in for one day, and they took a look at me, and then Gordon Bennett, who was in charge of things mm-hmm. at Channel 7, said, yeah, I think we'll have you on, young fella, and that's where it all started, 1984, 2nd of April.
So they were the days of Sandy Roberts.
Yep, Peter Landy.
Terry
Clifton was there at the time.
Was there a chance to do any calling then? What about when, because Seven had gone out, they'd gone away from the showgrounds and the Penthouse Club and things like that, when harness racing virtually went to Moonee Valley there for a little while, but then disappeared out of sort of race telecasting at that stage.
Yeah, not calling, but I did work on the racing broadcast that they were doing for a while there, and Terry was understudy to Bill for a long time there at Channel 7, so he did a lot of the calling, but no, it was more presenting, and that probably served me well at the time, even though I would have liked to have kept calling.
Mm. And then, of course, involved in that, you just away, while being in sport, of course, there's World of Sport,
mm-hmm.
World of Sport Replay, and you're making great roads into there and getting a chance to do that on a Sunday morning. And it was an institution in Melbourne. I know a lot of people listening, older brigade, would remember their Sunday morning ritual. If you, of course, you go to an early mass, early church, but you'd be there for 9 o'clock for the replay, 9 till 10, and then the sport from 10 till about 1.
Yeah, and institution is the right word. It was an institution, and half of the people who worked on it should have been in one, because it was chaos. It was organised chaos in there, but it was such a privilege to be there when you look at Lou Richards and Jack Dyer and Colin Long and John Dobby did the bowl segment, and I called the roller derby a few times.
On the bikes, yeah.
I think Terry Hammond fell off 3 times in one day. So that put the show about half an hour behind, and we were normally half an hour behind anyway.
Yeah,
it was great.
And Uncle Doug doing the live commercials, that was something special.
Yes, and Bill Collins would set fire to the idiot sheet, which was beside the camera. No auto cue in those days. Yeah. So Uncle Doug would read a bit quicker to get through.
Because the flames are coming up underneath. And, of course, the man who put all that together, one of the great sports broadcasters, Ron Casey.
Mm.
What a great operator he was. What a great Australian he was.
Well, he was instrumental in sport in television
without
in Victoria and Australia, and of course a driving force behind the North Melbourne Football Club, and he became general manager at Channel 7 for a long time. He was an incredible man. I remember his state funeral at St. Patrick's Cathedral, and it was a huge occasion. The who's who, not only of sport but broadcasting in Australia, was there to pay tribute to him, and he was an incredible influence on everyone at Channel 7 at the time.
It's amazing when you think back, and I had some of it when I was at 3DB working with Bill Collins, and of course we did some work on Channel 7 on some of those hosting things, those race replay mornings and Sunday morning. But when you reflect back at the time, you appreciated that you're working with greatness as far as broadcasters went, like Ron Casey, like Bill Collins. When you reflect back now, in time, they've probably got greater for what they did achieve and what they did create, what they set up for the future.
Yeah, and you probably didn't quite appreciate it at the time, and I'm sure you were the same. When I was at Channel 7 early, I used to do the late news on a Thursday night, and I'd go down to a little studio down the basement, which was only used to do league teams, and there was Jack, Bob and Lou, and I'd sit in the studio and watch league teams and think, I'm pretty lucky here, but it was only in latter years that I realised how lucky.
Yeah, exactly. Now, across to the 10 network in 89, would that be right?
Yep.
The first Melbourne Cup that you actually covered was 1989,
mm-hmm.
the Freedmans.
Yeah.
Lee Freedman winning with Terrific. I saw that recently on YouTube, and there's a very young Peter Donegan talking to a very young Lee Freedman, and he talks about, you know, what has just happened. Someone said, oh, and you ran second, superimposed was second, Lee. Oh, did we?
Yeah. And I said to him, nothing like the feeling of your first Melbourne Cup at the end of the interview, meaning your first Melbourne Cup victory. And he looked at me and said, this is my second. And so at the time I thought, hang on, I'm sure he hasn't won the Melbourne Cup before, but in that atmosphere, in that pressure cooker atmosphere, I doubted myself for a minute.
Yeah.
What he meant was it was his second runner in a Melbourne Cup.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And so we've laughed about that over the years. Yeah.
And in doing that, being with Channel 10 and going to the 7 network in 2002, why did that happen?
With the rights? Well, the rights went to Channel 7 from Channel 10, who had it until 2001. Ethereal was the last one.
Yeah.
And then 7 made a big play to get it, and they got it. And they didn't want to make it Channel 10 revisited. So there were two people that they took at the time. Fortunately, I was one of them, and our great friend John Letts was the other one. And Letts's not been in the best of health lately, but... hopefully he's doing okay.
Yeah, so I stay in touch with him. He's on the way back. He's missed the last couple of cups now, which has really hurt him.
Yeah,
but
he was brilliant.
Fabulous record. But when you reflect back from the 7 network from 2002, it was a good year to come back, as it turned out. It was Media Puzzle and Damien Oliver. Probably one of the most fantastic, most gut-wrenching stories around a Melbourne Cup. And not equal until this year, probably.
Never seen so many people crying on a race course as I saw that day when Media Puzzle came back to scale. It was an unforgettable day. And then, of course, 7 the next 3 years had Maccabi Diva 1, 2, and 3. And then we saw that great day in 2005 that you and I will never see again, and no one will ever see again, because no horse will ever win 3 Melbourne Cups in a row.
But even going back to Bart, you know, like through the 80s, no Melbourne Cup winners. You know, people had written Bart off, but back into 1990, Kingston Rule, 91, Let's Elope, Shiva's Revenge, the protest. You were the only one that had actually access to Bart and around that door outside the stewards' room, working with the 7 network, and the famous line that Bart gave you.
Yes, well...
standing there with the two jockeys.
Yeah. How does it feel to protest against yourself, Bart? Feels pretty good. Can't lose. but I remember that day, Brian, because everything around the Melbourne Cup is so heavily formatted with rundowns, and that hour goes internationally. When the protest siren sounded, that was the end of the rundown. Murray Lomax was the director at the time, the producer, and he gave me a direction in my earpiece, which I will never forget. He said 3 words. Just keep talking. And we had nothing to talk about for about 25 minutes. I still don't know what I said, but we got there.
Whatever you said worked, because people still talk about it. That's the important thing. It was brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant television.
Flying by the seat of your pants television.
They pay on that. They pay on that. It's called mastering the art of ad-lib, and you did it brilliantly.
Oh, well, that's live television, isn't it? You just have to keep on going. And I remember talking to Albie King. Stephen King rode the winner, and Albie's father was there. At that stage, I would have talked to Albie King's garbologist, had he been in the room, because I was looking for any sort of tenuous link to anything that was going on in there, because we couldn't go in the stewards' room at that time.
That's right, yeah.
You know, that was before all the cameras were in there, and we saw the protest hearings. We were just outside, and there was a bit of sweat on the brow going on out there. The television lights were making the atmosphere steamy. It was an incredible day, one that I won't forget, but I'll never forget those 3 words. Just keep talking.
For those who don't remember, it was Let's Elope who beat Shiva's Revenge. Let's Elope, Stephen King, Shiva's Revenge, Shane Dye, both trained by Bart Cummings. Protest second against first, alleging interference about the 300-metre mark.
Yeah, just at the top of the straight there, I think, when Stephen was on the best horse in the race and he decided that come hell or high water, he was getting out of the pocket that he was in. And he did throw a right hook at Shiva's Revenge. There was certainly interference there. Stuart's got it right, though. I don't think there was any change to the result. She would have won anyway.
Yeah, no doubt at all. But I think he got 6 weeks or something following it.
And more than happy to get 6 weeks.
Cop it, yeah. And then when we're going back on these Melbourne Cups and you're in this wonderful position of, as far as press people go and media people go, you're got first call to the trainer. And you've been there to have first call with the day the Melbourne Cup changed in 93. Vintage Crop won. And Dermot Well became a household name. The international stage stood up and said, hang on, an Irish horse has come all the way out here. The Melbourne Cup, we don't have it any. We don't own it anymore. It's changed forever.
Yeah, he said to me, the Melbourne Cup is the international two-mile championship of the world. It has changed as of this day. He's a wonderful man, Dermot Weld. I've had the opportunity of catching up with him every time that he's been back. I think that moment created a little bit of a bond between us. There's a great understanding between the two of us, and I admire him greatly. He's a wonderful man for racing.
One of the greatest trainers in the world, no doubt at all.
Yeah.
And then Doremus, 95, completed the double. The Freedmans again and Ollie. Saintly in 96 for Bart. Might and Power, 97 all the way. Jimmy Cassidy. How did you go with Jack Denham that day?
That's a very good question. I'm just trying to remember.
Because he didn't talk
back
to the media.
No, I think I may have spoken to Nick Moraitis that day.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that I spoke to Jack. You're testing my memory now, Brian. It's 18 years ago. I can't remember what I did yesterday.
Bart with Rogan Josh in 99. Yeah. And then we come into the new millennium, and you spoke about the three Maccabi Divas.
And Lee Friedman's line. And speaking of having first crack.
Third year, yeah.
When she won for the third time, Lee's told the story now that he sat there the night before and thought, what do I say if she wins? Do I just go through the usual things that you go through in post-race interviews? And he thought of that line, that now famous line. So when I went and spoke to him, and he came up with the line, go and find the youngest kid on this race course, because they will be the only person who will live long enough to see something like this happen again.
Yeah, it's a good line, wasn't it?
It was brilliant. Brilliant.
But it was so true, so factual.
And then just a month or so ago, Michelle Payne told everyone to get stuffed when I was interviewing her after the Melbourne Cup. And I thought that was just a great line too. It was so Australian.
Did that pull you up?
No. And I'll tell you why. And I haven't really spoken about this, so I'll tell you. It's so noisy down there and there are so many things coming in your earpiece that I wasn't sure that she'd actually said it. I thought she'd said it, but then I wasn't completely sure. So if you have a look at that back, you see me not really reacting to what she said. That's the reason why.
You couldn't actually hear it clearly.
I thought I did, but I wasn't sure.
Probably good that you didn't react to it because it was such a perfect line.
Oh, it was fantastic. What a day. What an incredible day.
Well, the emotion when she got out of the saddle and there's her brother, Stevie there, number 19.
Yeah.
And the raw emotion that just poured out. When those things happen, I believe the punt doesn't matter anymore. It's more about what have we just witnessed? What have we just seen here?
Yeah, well, it's a moment in Australian sporting history, and that's what we thought after Ollie, and that's what we thought after Maccabi Diva.
Yeah.
And I certainly thought that after Michelle won, that this race has been going since 1861. We've had to wait this long to see this moment. It'll never happen again because that's the first one. Another female jockey will ride the winner of the Melbourne Cup.
It's an historic moment.
Yeah, but the first one can never be taken away. And you can say you were there on that day. And she was so sweet about it. And I think everyone just loved the fact that she was able to win and handle it with such grace and just a bit of Aussie spirit as well.
Did you think that I've always sort of held this belief over the last few years with Americaine winning and Dunedin and Protectionist winning, the Cup's been taken away. And I thought, even coming into this year, I don't know whether we're ever going to get this back. How do we do it?
Well,
we did it, but how?
I don't think we'll get it back because it's too big now. It's too highly regarded by all of the people around the world. It's $6 million worth. It is the staying championship of the world. So I think we're probably resigned to the fact that half the field at least are going to be internationals. Whether they put a cap on the internationals is another thing, but then again, how can you say to people who have gone down the path to qualify for the race, no, there's only so many of you who can get in. It's a tough one.
How do you have an Australian Open in tennis or in golf and say restricted to Australians only?
Yeah, you can't possibly do that sort of thing. It's a worldwide event now, and long may it be a worldwide event in my eyes.
No doubt at all. Peter Donegan, our special guest this morning. Great to have Pete with us. This is your racing life. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Back with Peter Donegan this morning on This Is Your Racing Life. We've spoken about racing, Pete. But gee whiz, looking through your CV, I must have been living under a rock because I wasn't aware that you've covered the last six Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware that you've done four Commonwealth Games.
Yeah.
I was aware that you have been involved in the Australian Open Tennis Championships, but you've covered them for 17 years.
Yeah.
You've done the stall gift in a commentary or hosting position on 19 occasions. There's the baseball championships. There's a rugby league state of origin in Melbourne. There's AFL calling. There's world-class golfing events that you've done offshore for different networks around the world. So you've been seen by millions and millions and possibly billions of people globally. How have you done it?
Well, having heard you go through that, I'm a bit tired now, Brian. What do they say about jack of all trades and master of none?
Oh, no, you've mastered so much of this. One thing just has led from another. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially. Football was a thing that I've always done, and I've always loved footy, being a Melbourne boy. We share a similar football team, which is
black and white.
Yeah, probably why our hair was a bit black and white, but now mine's mainly white.
I'm on the way.
After what Collingwood's done over all the years. Yes. But always had a great interest in all sports, golf, and a stall gift is an amazing atmosphere. Love the event. John Russell.
We started up there together.
I think we might have.
I did the 77. I reckon I did about 78, 79.
Yeah, well, the first one I did for television was mid-80s.
Yeah.
And I've done every one since 2000. It's unique. You walk in those gates at Central Park, there's nothing like it.
No.
Golf events around the world, so... And the Olympics, of course, which is still the pinnacle, I think. To do the track competition in London was amazing. Because
that was for the Nine Network, 2012?
Because Bruce had done it for Channel 7 and Channel 10 since Bill did it. Bill Collins did it in 1980. Bruce had done every single track competition from 84 onwards. So it was a change. It was something that people weren't used to hearing. And to call the big fella Usain Bolt and... David Rudisha and Mo Farah and Sally Pearson's gold medal.
Yes, yeah.
I'll never forget it.
You're right. Those things, they're just etched in your mind, and they're fortunately etched on your CV too.
Yeah.
Great performance, you know, to accomplish that's the pinnacle.
Yeah, I was sort of sitting there before the runners were lining up on the blocks for the Olympic 100 metres final in that stadium in London, thinking...
Where did your mind go then, just pre that race?
You try and focus, because you know you've only got 9 and a bit seconds to get it right. But it did wander at one stage, and I thought, it's a long way from the Wangaratta Greyhounds to London Olympic Stadium.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
The boy from Albert Park.
Yes, yeah, and Mum and Dad will be listening to this show this morning. They've had their health challenges, but they were so encouraging over the years, as your parents were, Nancy and Jack, all those years ago, and it was wonderful to meet them along the journey too.
Well, they loved you. Dad Brian, from memory, had a milk bar in Albert Park. Richardson Street nearby somewhere?
Yes, it was on the corner of Richardson Street and Kerford Road. He had a grocer shop in Mill Street for many years, long since retired. And as I said, he's had his health issues. But, he loved footy. And he was a great South Melbourne man and still is a Sydney Swans man. And that's part of the reason that I got my love for footy as well. And Mum was just very proud of everything that I was able to do, as mums are.
Yeah.
You know, I could have called the tiddlywinks and she would have been happy.
She would have said, well done.
Yeah.
Well done.
So I owe them a lot.
Yeah, we all do. We owe our parents everything.
Yeah.
Pete, so they're on the blocks for the 100 metres 2012 Olympic Games. The butterflies, you've just got to get above it, don't you? You've just got to hold it together and know that I take the stand that I've been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
I'll get this. I've got to get this right. Get out and do it and enjoy it.
How many Melbourne Cups for you?
26.
Righto. So between us, we've done 27.
Yeah.
Still, when you call a Melbourne Cup, there's still that sense of urgency in the nerves,
yes,
because
absolutely.
You know you've only got one crack at it to get it right. And it's the same with an Olympic final, but Olympic final is over like that.
Yeah.
Whereas the Melbourne Cup, you got 3.5 minutes and everyone's had an investment and everyone in Australia has listened to it. But essentially, I don't know what you find, but even in Kiwis year, when they jumped out of the gates, it was a bit like another race.
Yeah.
Up until the 200.
Yep. I agree. And I think people ask you about calling races and calling Melbourne Cups, etc. I liken it to the horse and the jockey. They've got to get their breathing right. The horse's breathing's got to be right. You're up there, they're off.
Yeah.
You've got to come down.
Yep.
You can't stay up there and actually go higher. You've got to come down and get into a rhythm. And as they're breathing and the tempo's increasing, you know, with the riders on top of them, it's different from the 2000 as to when they're at the 800.
Mm.
And your level of calling, you know, at the 2000, so and so, 800 from home, and you're moving up to that level. Around the turn they come, you know, you're going to that next level, and still have something in reserve. For the last 300 metres, because that's when it's hell for leather.
And
everyone's
thing,
going for it.
The other thing that people might not realise from a technical aspect, and I'm sure you've realised this, and I did in my Melbourne Cup when Bianco Lady went up outside the leader at the 1400 metre mark, that sometimes you can't see them.
They're
3/4 of a mile away from you. And if your hands are shaking on the binoculars, it's like an earthquake.
That's exactly right.
So you've got to try and keep yourself calm. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do. But, essentially, to me, it was a bit like another race. And strangely enough, I was quite calm before the Olympic 100 metres final. But there were moments in London where I just looked around and I thought, look at the enormity of this. This is extraordinary.
Well, it doesn't get any bigger.
No.
You've got to suck it up and realise there's nothing bigger than this in terms of a broadcaster.
Yeah, and Sally's gold medal, of course, she won by 0.02 of a second, and I was absolutely positive she'd won.
Yeah, brave call, but right.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have called it that way had I not been sure. And I said on air afterwards, I looked around the box, and of course there were people everywhere, and Jane Fleming was doing the call with me, and Jane's looking at me as if to say,
not sure.
I'm not sure that she's won this. So it's going through my mind, Australia's watching this. Their golden girl has been aiming for this moment, and I've just mucked it up. And that 15 or 20 seconds before her name went up on the semaphore board was like about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But looking at it again, there's a margin there.
Yeah.
You know what it's like.
Yep.
Sometimes the margin is the narrowest of margins, but you call it as you see it.
Exactly right. So that's the games, the Olympic Games, the highest, as I say, that you can aspire to.
Hmm.
What about 4 days of golf? World Championship golf, the highest level of you know, international golfing.
Yeah, it's interesting because you sit there for 5 hours, as we did for 12 days over the last 3 weeks, and we are looking at what everyone sees at home. We're not sitting there looking out onto the golf course for the most part, but for 5 hours we have someone talking in our ears while we're talking.
Yeah.
Telling you what's coming up next, where to go to, the fact that you've got to get to breaks and you have to do it to the second at certain times for the rest of the world to join you. So you come off air after 5 hours and you are mentally drained.
Yes.
And then you've got to back up the next day and do it again.
How do you do that?
Practice makes perfect, I think. You get used to it after a while. When you first do it, it really is, it's just, it frazzles your brain.
I think a lot of people believe that these golfing tours and golfing, you know, tournaments, that the players and the media all go to the bar every night.
Mm. Well, it used to be that way, certainly with the players, but now players spend time in the gym. When I'm away in various countries around the world, more often than not, I'll go back to the hotel room, get myself up on the internet, on the Wi-Fi, and do some homework for the next day.
Yeah.
Because you've got to have those things at your fingertips for 5 hours.
Do you have much interaction with those champion players?
Some, in particular with the women, Brian, because I do a lot of LPGA tournaments and have developed a great friendship with some of the players over the years. The girls are great. I get it. The guys play for $7 million every week on the PGA Tour, and they are looked after, and they don't really have to do that much. It looks after itself. The girls know that they have to promote the sport.
Mm.
And so I've had the opportunity of sitting down with the likes of Kari Webb and Michelle Wee and Stacey Lewis and Enby Park and all of the top players in the world and do 20-minute chats with them. And they're great with their time, and I really appreciate the fact that they get it. We're all working towards the same thing.
So you're virtually saying the guys, because of where they sit status-wise and the money involved, there's still a big gap between men and women's golf?
Oh, yeah, well, certainly prize money-wise.
Yeah, we know that. Yeah.
The LPGA Tour is kicking a lot of goals because they are a world tour now. They're going to various countries throughout Asia. They have an event here in Australia. They've realised that they couldn't stay in the States and to make it profitable. So they've taken it around the world. They've done it very well. They're the best in their profession. They're very personable. Like everyone, they have their moments, but they have very few moments. So I'm a great advocate for them and what they do with their game and their tour.
Just away from that particular sport, you've been so synonymous with the VFL, and you've been very much responsible, I believe, of elevating the VFL to where it is now. Is that still happening with the ABC?
No, Channel 7 have taken over the VFL coverage.
That's right. Yeah, I saw that this season. Yeah.
I think they're doing an excellent job with it. I don't think my involvement with the VFL was wonderful for 13 years, but it was Phil Cleary who was the face of the VFL. Yeah. He was the one who publicised it.
Yeah.
We had some interesting times over the years, both on and off air. We had an argument on air one day about the legitimacy of a tackle. Phil, once he has made his point, is very strong at sticking to that, and I admire a man who does that, but it came over on air that we disagreed. And so basically I said to him, righto, you've had your say, let's get on with calling the game. But we're fine, we're good. And we had some discussions before a grand final many years ago, just before we went on air, but he's a good man.
Does a lot, not only for sport, but for the community.
Oh, he does.
What his different beliefs. And
that competition as
well. Yeah. He is a good man. You're right. So, Pete, when you look across the Seven Network in the 80s, there were grand finals, AFL going into, before that, of course, the VFL. All these different classics we've spoken about with the golf and the Tiger skins in Singapore through Phuket and Thailand. It just goes on and on and on. You don't mind living out of a suitcase?
Oh, look, it gets to you after a while, Brian.
Yeah,
it does get to you, I think, the older you become as well. You spend a lot of time at airport lounges, which is not such a bad thing, but depends on which seat in the plane you're sitting on, whether it's a test
or
not.
Yeah.
Yes, up the front makes it a little bit easier. But, yeah, living out of a suitcase is tough. But then I think, how many people would love to be doing this? How many people would love to be here? I'm so privileged. I'm so lucky. And I'll never lose sight of that.
When you go back, and most people sort of identify you at the moment in the world we live at the moment, is that Channel 7 racing coverage, and Channel 7 are moving more into more racing with, you know, Channel 7 2 and 7 Mate, and, you know, the extension goes on. Now we've got racing.com associated with them. But when you look at your team, Bruce McAvaney, none better in the business.
Yep.
Francesca Camani, who now calls Australia home.
Got nothing going for her, the poor girl.
No, a bit plain, isn't
she?
The Simon Marshall, Simon O'Donnell, Joe Griggs in her area, Hamish McLaughlin, great operator, Neil Kearney with what he does. It's a fabulous team, and the coverage, I get to see a little bit of the coverage because normally I'm in the box, you know, in the commentary box, but it's gone to a new level.
Mm,
the mix is right. They've got it absolutely right.
Yeah, because this is, as much as we love the racing side of it, there are 90% of people out there who don't take any interest in racing until that week. So it's an event coverage. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a racing coverage, but it's an event coverage.
Yeah.
It's about what goes on off the track as much as what goes on the track. And that mix you talk about is so important, and I think we have got it right.
Yeah, Pete, so who are you employed by? Are you on separate contracts, say, with Seven? And how does that all work?
Yeah, I've got an agreement with Seven to do the events for them, the racing and the tennis and various other things, the golf now, because they've gone heavily into that.
Yeah.
But I do a lot of work for IMG, International Management Group, which is who I do the golf for overseas. Some people have speculated that what I should do is just have a little Velcro logo on the jacket that I have. So peel off the 7-1 and put the 10-1 on, because I used to do the store gift for 10, and I did the Commonwealth Games for 10 last year. And Nine actually completed the set when I did the Olympic Games for them. So, yes, I'm a little free with my morals when it comes to what logo is going to be on the jacket, but people have been asking me, and I've been lucky to say yes.
I'm looking at the jacket you wear this morning. It's the Volvo China Open.
Yes. Yeah, it was there and did a couple of China Opens over the last couple of years, or a few years ago. Brett Rumford, the Australian, won 1 year, and he played as well as anyone I've ever seen on the final day. And so as an Aussie overseas, you think, yeah, that's great to see things like that in such a far-flung place.
Where to next?
Oh, more of the same, I think, Brian.
What's the next gig?
Next gig is tennis, and then we go on to a little bit more golf, women's golf in Singapore and Thailand, back for racing. Football season starts then, and then at the end of July, start of August, there's that little sports carnival that they have in Rio de Janeiro. Yeah.
Yeah. All set for that?
Yeah, I'll be going over there. Not working for Seven. I'll be actually working for Olympic Broadcasting. For their coverage that goes out to the world, and do the opening ceremony and the track competition. So
track, that's good. Yeah. That's good. So that'll be Olympic Games number 7.
It will. Yeah. And the first one I did was Barcelona in 1992, and I did it for the Asian Broadcasting Union, and I did 4 weeks. We worked for about 16 to 18 hours a day. Sometimes we didn't get away from the IBC, the International Broadcast Centre, because we had so much to do, so we'd sleep on the floor there. So I worked 18 hours a day for 4 weeks solid at my first Olympic Games. Sure. My pay packet for the entire Games was $1,000. And so I said, oh, I can't do this again. I am not doing this again. That is it. One Olympic Games will do it for me. And so here we are on the verge of number 7. Thankfully, it's a little bit more than $1,000 these days.
Well, it should be. You should be right up there with the best of them and get paid accordingly. This has been a fabulous time for me this morning to reminisce back on where it all started for Peter Donegan and to where it's all happening now in your life. I wish you so much more success. Above all, good health, and it's just been great to chat with you this morning.
And as I said at the top of the program, Brian, I wouldn't be sitting in this spot and talking about all the things that I've done if it wasn't for your support for a young man coming into the caper, and you and Jill and little Beck and Tim, not so little anymore, made me feel so welcome, so I'm very grateful to you.
Good on you. Thank you, Pete.
Good on you, Brian.
Peter Donegan, great guy. Our special guest this morning, this is Your Racing Life. For Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.